TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. On this program, Debbie Millman talks with Peter Ringbaum about his years as a partner in the creative agency Flat and how he later moved away from design into filmmaking.
Obviously, like the visual end of filmmaking is incredibly important to me, and in some ways I think that's where I start. It has to be something that grabs me visually, and I tend to lead with that.
Here's Debbie Millman.
Peter Ringbaum went to South Africa with one camera and a vague idea of what he was going to film. He quickly realized that he needed to tell the story of South African artists 20 years after the end of apartheid. It would become his latest documentary, Shield and Spear. Documentary film is not Peter Ringbaum's only creative pursuit. He's also a designer, an art director, and has worked with clients as diverse as the Museum of Modern Art and ESPN. He is also the creative advisor for the design and innovation firm Open Box. He joins me now at the School of Visual Arts in New York City to talk about his career and his recent documentaries. Peter, welcome to Design Matters.
Thank you for having me.
So, Peter, you were born in Sweden, mm-hmm. but moved to the West Coast in 1994.
Right.
Why?
Because I met a girl.
Really? Oh, okay. So you left your whole family in Sweden and moved to the West Coast.
I was 20. You know, these things are easy to do when you're 20 and in love. Oddly, it didn't last. I mean, who would have thought?
Who would have thought? Especially so young and vibrant yeah. and full of optimism.
I mean, the other part of it was that I was going to design school. So I started out on the West Coast at a school and then lasted for about a year. And then I moved to the East Coast.
What school were you at that point?
Academy of Art.
Oh, so okay. And then you transferred to Cooper Union.
That's right.
And what made you decide to do that aside from the fact that it's a school that at that time you could go to for free?
I read a book about Milton Glaser. That was the starting point for it. I wasn't happy in San Francisco for many reasons. I wasn't happy with the school and I wasn't happy with the city. And it was just not for me at that point. So I read this book about Milton Glaser and I really loved his work. And it said there, but Milton Glaser went to Cooper Union. And I had no idea what that meant, except for it also said that it was a free school. So I figured that's perfect because that's what I need.
And so you moved and went to Cooper Union from 1996 to 1999.
Right.
And in doing my research on your history, I realized that you started Flat, your design firm, with your partner, Saya Carson, in 2000.
Well, I didn't start. They started it. I joined a couple of years after they started it.
So you went straight from school to a partner in a design
firm?
No,
it took about a year of being an employee, and then I became a partner.
A year, a whole year. You had to suffer through employment for an entire year before you were made a partner.
Right. Well, being a partner is not necessarily always better than being an employee.
But it's certainly more prestigious.
I guess so.
So how did you meet Saya, and how did you get to Flat?
I met Saya through this designer, Barbara Glauber, who was a teacher of mine at Cooper, who I loved. And she played matchmaker. She knew them and thought that I would be a good addition to their company. At that point, they were not a visual design company.
They were primarily interactive.
Yeah,
right?
And they did mostly information architecture for companies, and they didn't really have a visual portfolio. So I came in and built out their visual side and then joined as a partner.
A year later.
Yeah.
And then you stayed for 12 years.
Right.
Now, Flat's portfolio includes commercial, artistic, entertainment, educational, political engagements. Some of the work that I think they're most noted for while you were there, for the 12 years you were there, were some of the work for the ING New York City Marathon, mm-hmm. Isaac Mizrahi's online presence.
Right.
And in terms of Isaac's website, Flat, I believe, focused on two areas, an editorial space that worked hand in hand with a print publication, a store that sold online merchandise, but it also served as a centralizing presence for all of Isaac's activities, from his couture line to his Target brand, from his magazine to his television show. So what was it like working with a fashion celebrity?
Well, I mean, just to be clear, the print part was actually done by Peter Buchanan Smith. And he's
the one
who brought
yes.
us in.
You know, okay.
He's a friend from long back.
And we'll talk about Peter in a moment because sure. he's in one of your films.
Right. That's true. How was it like working with Isaac Mizrahi? Interesting. He's quite an entertaining character.
Interesting is never a good word. I happen to love Isaac, and I've known him for about 30 years, believe it or not.
Yeah.
But just the word interesting as a sort of cultural phenomenon is never a good thing to say about someone.
It's better than boring.
That's true. That's true. Just
and he's certainly not a boring person.
Absolutely.
And not a boring client at all. No, he's very entertaining. He's great, incredibly passionate, incredibly design-minded and smart, also incredibly challenging.
You also did work for the Red Cross, and I know that the Red Cross approached Flat to represent their response to 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And you based your approach on a standard used extensively for the profit world, which was the annual report.
Mm-hmm.
And the website and the printed publication was the first of its kind for the organization and has since become a model for reporting on other large-scale relief efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was widely noted that you avoided depicting the drama of the event and the heroism of its participants. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about why you chose that particular approach.
Because the report itself is a mix of stories and a lot of numbers and facts. What we wanted to do is to try to get to the intimacy of the people who survived and were part of the relief effort, but also the families of victims, etc. And we did that through artifacts. So the Red Cross had an extensive collection of objects that they had collected and that people had given them and people sent in from all over the world. And they were amazing. You know, everything from, a charred American flag to little stuffed animals to hazmat suits that were used in the relief effort, helmets, etc. So we let those objects tell the story. Because at that point, we had seen the images so many times. And it was important for us to try to stay away from that and use a different way in, to tell that story.
So you walked away from Flat, or you left Flat in 2012. I believe it was after you won a Webby Award nomination for a documentary video that you created for 5 Franklin Place. What made you decide to leave and ultimately completely change your career path?
It was actually a change that started long before that. I've started making small film projects on the side, sometimes bringing them in as part of Flat, little fashion videos and commercial work, music videos, etc. Sometimes just by myself, narrative shorts. I felt like I was actually working towards making that shift over many years. In 2011, I got a call from this musician named John Forte, and I knew who he was because I used to be a fan of the Fugees, or I guess I still am. So I was extremely surprised that he would call me, but he asked.
How did he even know about you?
He had seen a fashion video I did for this jewelry brand and liked it. And he asked me if I wanted to come to Russia to document a tour he was making, which I thought was incredibly interesting and weird.
We'll talk about this at length in a few minutes.
But this is actually why I left at that time. Because I left to go to Russia in 2011, took a leave of absence from Flat, and tried to come back after I returned from Russia and, you know, worked part-time while finishing my film. And it just didn't work. I just couldn't do both things. So I had to make a choice. It just wasn't realistic for me to run a design firm while also making feature-length documentaries. This didn't hold up. And it was also not really fair to my partners, to be honest. So that's why I left.
And did you always know that you'd ultimately be successful at pursuing film? Were you worried? Were you scared? Did you feel insecure? it's really remarkable to give up a partnership in a design firm that's really hot, really well-known, doing great work, and go off and decide to do something that you have to sort of make a whole new name for yourself doing.
I was worried, yes. Not necessarily about my ability, but yes, about about money, really, about supporting myself and my family. But it wasn't hard because I felt like my life at Flat had run its course. It was time to move on.
Now, was it something that you felt in your heart?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something specific. It was just something that you sensed about the direction of your life.
Yeah, it was an important thing to do. And I think age is part of this. I felt like if I was going to make that shift, it would have to be at that point or now, essentially, you know, now or never in some ways. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. People can change course in their lives at any time, really. And I like to think that way. But maybe some like early real, I wouldn't say it's a midlife crisis, but it was, I assessed my life from a personal level and a professional level, what have you. And I felt deep in my heart that I had to try to do something else to make myself more excited and happy. And to kind of rediscover a passion for something that I felt like I had lost along the way.
You worked on a conceptual film with Carl Handel.
Mm-hmm.
And this was work that was based upon an eponymous series of conceptual graphite drawings that he did beginning in 2007 that you then turned into a film that you called Questions for My Father.
Yeah.
This was the last of the pieces of yours that I watched in doing my research on you to prepare for the show today. And in many ways, it was the most moving to me because it felt so completely universal in that these questions for the fathers, and I'll explain the film in a moment, felt like questions anybody could ask anyone at any time. And I'm wondering if those questions in some way inspired you to rethink the course of your life at that time.
Yeah. the reason why that project came about was I discovered a painting by Carl that affected me deeply. And I think that had to do with where I was in my life at that time. And I was becoming, maybe a little late in my life, but I was coming a man, you know, and I was thinking about all of these things, like what does it mean really to be a man, and what does it mean to be a dad? And I think a lot of men in their 30s these days ponder these things, right? So that painting affected me deeply, and I reached out to Carl, and we decided to do this project together, and we've now since become really great friends and continue to work on things. But yes, it was a timely project.
As I was watching all of your movies, all of as many as I could, your music videos, your branded films, and because this was the last piece of yours that I saw, suddenly everything clicked. And I thought, oh, my God, this was the inspiration to change his whole life. But the film has been described as a document of sorts of the inquiries, the doubts and reservations of a group of 16 men in the 30s and 40s, including you. You are in it as well. Each man makes several appearances. They look directly into the camera and ask a short question that, as we continue to watch the film, we realize is intended for the speaker's father.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to read some of the questions. So here goes. Did you ever lose faith in yourself? Do you like yourself? Did you know I was scared of you? Do you ever wish your life turned out differently? Why don't I believe in your sacrifice? Did you foresee my marriage failing? Why did my mom divorce you? Why are you afraid of being alone? How did you find out you were HIV positive? Are you afraid of dying? Were you scared the day I was born? Was I a mistake? Do you ever wish you had a different life? Why did you wear a tux to my playoff game? Why do you dot your I's with a circle? Why don't you take risks? What did you do at work all day? How does it feel knowing I was raised by another man? How many brothers and sisters do I have? Do you miss having a family? Do you ever think about getting in touch with me? Do you search my name on the internet? What do you want to know about me? What things can I tell you? Are you still alive? Amazing, right? These right. questions are amazing. Were these questions that the men mm-hmm. wrote themselves and you edited and chose which ones they wanted to ask, or was it just free reign? They could say whatever they wanted?
We asked our friends to submit questions, and then we edited. We recorded basically all the questions that they had and then edited the ones we felt like told a story in the best way.
It's just an extraordinary, and the photography, the cinematography is absolutely gorgeous, the close-ups, the mm-hmm. eye contact that you have with each man. What did you learn about yourself making this film?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about the questions is that you learn something about the fathers, but you also learn a lot about the sons, the people yes. asking the questions. You know, the things that they're actually interested in tell the story of them. Right. So the things that I were interested in were things that I was thinking about myself, essentially. And the things that I probably didn't like about myself that I could see in my dad, you know.
Well, hell yeah. You don't have to be a guy to feel that way.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's like a psychological exercise or something, you know. And it was a tricky project to do, and it was a very tricky thing to show to my dad because he saw it. He came to New York when we had it installed at a gallery in Chelsea, and he saw it.
What did he say?
I was actually incredibly proud of him because I was nervous. I thought, you know, because there are some hard questions in there. But he loved it. I mean, it helps that he's an artist, so he could see it from, I think, from an artist's point of view. But I was nervous for no reason, as it turns out. Even the things that I thought were a little sensitive, it didn't bother him at all.
Yeah, I only ask the R-rated questions. There are some X-rated questions,
sure.
too.
Yeah.
You have done quite a number of other film projects. You've shot a number of music videos. You've created a number of branded films. I want to talk a little bit about your documentaries. Mm-hmm. I want to talk first about your first feature film, the documentary The Russian Winter, which, mm-hmm. as you just recently told us, was motivated by the call from John Forte.
Right.
John Forte is the ex-Fuji producer and the member of OK Player for Life. His story has the sort of grandeur of being documentary worthy. For some context, John Forte grew up fatherless and poor in Brownsville, Brooklyn. He got a full music scholarship to Phillips Exeter, one of the best prep schools in the country. At 21 years old, he received a Grammy nomination for his work on the Fugees album, The Score, and then embarked on a critically acclaimed solo career. In 2000, he was arrested at Newark Airport for carrying $1.4 million worth of liquid cocaine. He was then sentenced to a mandatory 14 years in prison. He served 7 and then had his sentence commuted in 2008 by George W. Bush at the urging of a pair of very unlikely supporters, mm-hmm. The singer Carly Simon and the Republican Utah Senator Orrin Hatch.
Right.
The documentary has pretty much nothing to do with the Fugees, Carly Simon, or growing up poor in Brooklyn, although all are touched upon. It really centers around a 9-week musical journey that Forte took across Russia in 2011. This is a trip that he had to obtain special permission from his parole officer for. What made him decide to trust you mm-hmm. to do a documentary about his experience, having never made a feature documentary before?
Yeah.
Big question,
That's a
right?
Good question.
He just liked you.
Well, right? It's a process because he originally, I don't think he thought of it being a documentary about him. You know, he thought, oh, I'm going to make this tour. So you come along, you document a tour and it'll be like a musical journey like, you know,
Like Madonna's The Girly Show or Truth or Dare.
Right,
or,
exactly. Yeah. A tour diary. That's what exactly. He imagined. And he had seen, you know, these shorter pieces that I made that he really liked. And he really liked the aesthetic. He knew that it would be a beautiful piece about, you know, his travel through Russia. And that was, I think, as far as he had planned it. Of course, I wanted to make something that went a little deeper than that. It became really a film about him, but we are traveling through Russia as we are getting to know who he is.
And you really see him. You don't hold back very much. And I was impressed by his allowing you to show him at his best and maybe his most arrogant or his worst, depending on, right. You know, how you want to view arrogance.
I'm glad that he did that. I mean, part of that is shooting all the time. So we were in Russia for 2.5 months and we were shooting every day. Eventually, the filters go away and you just let it all hang out. And that's what happened. And most of the stuff that really have that drama to it happened towards the end of this trip, because at that point, the barriers had come down and people were just who they were.
I was really struck by watching John Forte on this tour, of seeing him treated as a celebrity, right. Of being so admired by so many people that right. wanted to have his picture taken and go to his shows and so on and so forth. But there are a couple of lines in the movie that are just spectacular in their sort of vivid starkness, I guess. And he says about his prison experience, every week something is being taken away from you when you're in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Did you learn something about the notion of freedom or what it was like to be in jail and then suddenly free?
Yeah, I mean, I think at that time, John was still getting used to being free. He was still getting used to operating in society. He was away from 7 years is a long time to be away. And he went away really young. And one thing he says, and I don't know if this is in the film or not, but one thing he says is that you get frozen in prison, like time stands still. So he went in as a young 20-something.
21, 22,
right.
Something like that.
And he came out as a young 20-something. Not in age, but in his life experience, really. Like, you can read books, right? So he's an intellectual fellow, and he's read a lot, and he read a lot in prison. But when you're not interacting with real life for 7 years, that does something to your personality. And I think that when we made that film, he'd just been out of prison for about a year or so, and he's still, like, navigating, you know, how to operate with freedom, how to trust people again, and how to
be seen.
And that was tricky. Yeah,
I mean, and not only are you being seen,
right.
but you're being filmed.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful movie. The movie debuted at the Tribeca Film Festival. How did you make that happen? How do you get your first feature film to be debuted at the Tribeca Film Festival?
I don't know. I did. It's a lottery, really, with the festival circuit. But we were very happy to get to premiere it there. I guess they liked the film.
So that paved the way for your next film, mm-hmm. a film called Shield and Spear, your most recent film. Can you describe the documentary for our listeners?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a portrait of a group of artists, contemporary artists and musicians working in South Africa 20 years after the end of apartheid. And through them, we're painting a picture of what's going on in the country now.
I read when you were growing up, your parents were very active in the anti-apartheid movement.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you?
I don't want to overstate that, because they were active in that in the same way that a lot of Swedes were, meaning they wore the buttons and they went into protests and what have you. They didn't put their lives on the line for the struggle, so I don't want to overstate it.
Okay.
But I remember, you know, going into these protests with them, for a lot of protests, but that was like the era, you know, the 70s in Sweden.
Better.
Yeah, yeah. Very much so. But the thing with the apartheid struggle in Sweden in general was actually outside of Africa, the continent. I think the Scandinavian countries were maybe the ones that were the most involved in the struggle. That's recognized in South Africa as well. Like, I went to Cape Town to this archive of protest art from the apartheid era, and they had this whole section with things from Scandinavia, the stickers that I like recognize. Oh, this is like what my mom wore on her shirt, whatever. Subconsciously, I think that's why I ended up making this film. Like, that was something that was lingering in me, kind of figuring out what happened after 1994 when everyone said that, you know, now South Africa is free, Nelson Mandela is the president, let everything, you know, everything is great, so we can all live happily ever after. And that was the story that was told again and again and again. But I really, you know,
and
I was curious.
Not, yeah, it's
no,
not
that's
at
not
all.
Really how it is. So I was curious to explore that. on a personal level, that was just interesting to me, and I felt like it could be a story that other people would find interesting.
I was struck by the notion that though Shield and Spear and The Russian Winter are really different films, mm-hmm. they both deal with artists in really uniquely political, somewhat extreme circumstances.
Right.
Was that intentional?
I think I'm drawn to that. So, yeah, I think that's intentional. Like I said, my dad was an artist. I feel like I lived my whole life in the art world in some way or another. But I always find it kind of frustrating that it's rare that it gets out of the box, you know, the white box, the gallery space, the art museum space, what have you. I'm really interested in those stories where it affects life, you know, on a social political level. And in South Africa, it does. There is a direct connection between art and politics in a way that probably doesn't happen in this country. One of the main thorough line of the film is the story around this painting called The Spear, you know, where we get our title.
Murray, yeah.
Right. And that painting had an immediate effect on social political life in South Africa. You know, it's a caricature. It's not the most amazing painting ever. You know,
no,
it's
it's
a caricature of the president with his, you know, his
genitalia hanging out of his pants.
Exactly. It's a one-liner, you know.
It is a one-liner.
But it led to these incredible protests and vandalism and death threats and eventually to a lawsuit and Brett having to go into hiding and et cetera. And it led to a big debate around race.
And freedom of expression. I mean, it feels like a film about freedom of expression at its heart.
Right. Sure.
And you start the film with some context here. You state that South Africa has one of the most progressive constitutions in the world. Mm-hmm. Its Bill of Rights includes the rights to human dignity, education, housing, and freedom of expression. Yet, in 2012, President Zuma and the ANC sued two different artists for work that they deemed offensive.
Yeah.
One of those artists was Brett Murray, who
right.
painted the caricature mm-hmm. That we were just talking about. So there were two real parallel stories happening. One mm-hmm. is about Brett Murray and the whole sort of situation that occurs in South
right.
Africa and what happens with the media. And then the other track of this documentary of all the musicians
right.
and all of the political activists that are trying to communicate what is happening in South Africa. Mm-hmm. How did they feel about Brett Murray's work and the protests that were going on? Because
mm-hmm.
you sort of weave in and out of
right.
the story that's happening while you're there and then the musicians and their lives and what they're trying to achieve.
I mean, specifically about the painting?
Yeah. Did they feel like it was – like the situation was overblown or that it was –
It varies. I mean
– But that his work wasn't any good or was very good? I'm just curious as
right.
to what they thought.
A lot of the artists that I met – kind of didn't think much of the painting itself. A universal thing I encountered was a strong belief in his right to make that painting. There were also some artists that felt like it was offensive and that he was, you know, that it came from a racist place. So it's a mix. But I would say most of them actually fell on the side of, not that great of a painting, but he should be allowed to paint that painting without risking the life of himself or his family. Which is a pretty fair assessment, I would say.
Milsu Thando Bongela talks about something that she refers to in the film as Nouveau African Confidence.
Mm-hmm.
She talks about the physical and psychological space to be the people we were born to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you have any insight into what that means.
I think she means that hundreds of years of oppression has affected, you know, generations of South Africans in the way that they suppressed so much of their creativity, of their political life, of their personal life, etc., that they were not fully human during the struggle. But how couldn't you be? I mean, if you have a...
Well, when you're that oppressed,
right.
yeah.
Now, with South Africa being a free country, I think what she's saying is that we finally have the opportunity to be fully human, to be everything that we want to be, and to, you know, engage on an equal level.
You feature Zanella Muholi mm-hmm. prominently in the documentary. She is a Black lesbian photographer, the ex-minister of culture, In South Africa, Lulu Zingwana refused to open a show with Zanella's work, calling it immoral, offensive, and going against nation building. Mm-hmm. And she talks about how photography is about politics. Can you talk about the experience of working with her a bit?
She's a tough cookie.
Yes. Compelling, though. Really.
Yeah,
compelling.
She's great. She's great on camera, off camera, not the easiest person to be around. I understand that, too, though. I mean, it's a tricky thing in general, being who I am and making this film in that country. You know, I'm a
You
don't
white
see
man.
Me, but I'm a white middle-aged man. I'm heterosexual, and I come from a privileged place. I mean, my background was not privileged, but
comparatively speaking, yes.
So there is a level of mistrust that for some people is immediate. And you have to, and it's my responsibility to kind of work to get past that. And with Zanella, it took a little time, but, you know, eventually I think we met as fellow, you know, creative types, really. I mean, I don't call myself an artist at all, but, you know, we met as people who are essentially doing similar things and who respect each other's work. The only reason why she agreed to be in the film is because she understood that I, you know, that I'd done some work before and she liked it. And
wanted to get her message out.
Right. But she usually says no to everyone. So, I mean, I think part of it is just that she felt like I would do a decent job at it.
Well, there are some really important statistics that she cites that you also feature prominently, and that is that South Africa has the highest reported incidence of rape in the world. Mm-hmm. That according to statistics, 20 South American women will be raped in the time it would take for somebody to watch Shield and Spear.
Right.
And then when the ANC files the lawsuit against the Goodman Gallery, Brett Murray and the city press demanding to have the painting removed from the gallery and the website of the newspaper, they are threatened with being stoned, lots of death threats, mm-hmm. something called being necklaced.
Right.
Their phones were monitored and tapped. They still don't even know if the taps were ever taken off.
Right.
Murray ended up having to take refuge at a friend's house far away from where the gallery was. Despite multiple requests, the ANC never granted you an interview. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, there is no point of view from the government
right.
other than it being seen as something that needed to be taken down and shut away.
Right. Sadly.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that the documentary has helped with the notion of freedom of expression in South Africa?
I think it's part of a bigger debate. I think that the ANC learned their lesson with the Spear, and I don't think that they won't act the same way again. You know, for our film, for example, we screened it at Durban Film Festival a couple of months ago, and any film that screens there has to go through the government censory board. So I know that they've seen it. Someone part of the government has seen the film and decided to just, you know, let it pass, which was probably a smart move from them. You know, it's better to ignore than to make a fuss, because that would just bring more attention to the film. But in terms of the freedom of expression issue, I think it's part of a debate that the country is having and has had since the Spear incident. Yeah, and I think it's actually in a better place now than it was 2 years ago when that happened.
So, Petter, one of the things that struck me throughout watching all of your films and also looking at your earlier design work mm-hmm. is how painterly everything is. Mm-hmm. Everything is very vivid. Everything is very beautiful and lush. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you feel you've taken from your earlier design career?
Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's hard to know where things come from, isn't it? Obviously, like the visual end of filmmaking is incredibly important to me. And in some ways, I think that's where I start. It has to be something that grabs me visually. And I tend to lead with that. And that's just where I come from. You know, that's my background and that's where I'm comfortable. So I let that lead the way in the films. It's definitely related to the design work. I mean, it all kind of blend together in some ways.
I want to close the show today with a quote that you include in Shield and Spear from Desmond Tutu. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And I think that's so important to remember. Thank you for being on the show today, Petter.
Thanks for having me.
You can find out more about Petter Ringbaum on his website, petterringbaum.com. That's Petter with two T's. I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we could make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.